Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City. Friends, Brian Diaz here with you at NOLA Drinks. Yep, friends, we got a great show coming up for you today. I appreciate you tuning in this week, as always, whether you're listening here on the radio WGSO or whether you are listening in podcast land, wherever you may be. Let's see, what do we got coming up first? We tape most of the show in both instances, both of our interviews at the newly opened Long Way Tavern, a new LeBlanc Smith restaurant, good friends of the show, and it's their new spot located at 719 Toulouse, right there smack dab in the middle between Bourbon and Royal. It's a cool new spot. They opened up a week ago today, actually, if you're listening on the radio. Really fine spot. It's inspired by mid-20th century Americana, which we talk about, and some of the design, what they're going for with some classic cocktails, I think sort of elevated cocktails, but not super pricey or anything along those lines, some small plate food stuff, that sort of thing. And so we actually tape that part of the show. We're joined initially by Robert LeBlanc, who is the main proprietor, managing partner of the LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group. They also operate Sylvain, Cavin, Mobar, and Barrel Proof here in town. And also Liam Deegan, who is the managing partner in Long Way Tavern, and also the managing partner in Barrel Proof. So the second time that Robert has teamed up with Liam under the LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group to open a new spot, and we chat with those two guys about the space and, as I just said, everything that's going on there at Long Way Tavern. And then we move into our featured interview, which Robert stays with us, and then we are joined by Nick Dietrich. And Nick is a very smart, talented restaurateur here in town as well. Currently, he is operating Manolito, which is a Cuban-themed bar located on Dumaine right there at the corner of Decatur. And it's driven, as I said, a Cuban-themed bar. It's very cool. They're trying to honor the tradition of the Cuban cantinero, which is the bartender tradition in Cuba. And we're actually in a couple weeks, going to be taping the show there. They've already opened, but they're doing their big grand opening with great fanfare coming up fairly soon. And so we're going to go talk a little bit about the Cuban bartending tradition, the inspiration for their spot. However, what we do here in this particular segment, which we do from time to time, every 3 months or so thereabouts, usually Robert joins us and then other folks rotate in. In this case, this first time Nick's joined us for this segment, where we talk about the state of the restaurant business with a particular focus here in New Orleans, of course, and also on independent sit-down operations, so bars and restaurants, sort of upscale fine dining in some cases. But it's a broad swath. I think a lot of the things that we talk about apply not only to New Orleans, but also apply to the larger industry, at least here in the United States, as it relates to those types of businesses. And one of the things I always appreciate about these segments is the honesty and candor with which our guests speak. Robert is very good with this, and anybody else that we bring in to discuss this is also very good with being very honest about their successes and their failures, some of the challenges that we see, giving an honest assessment of the landscape. And we talk extensively with those guys about that. I think if you're into the industry, if you're part of the industry, if you're an enthusiast likes to go out and eat and drink, be it in New Orleans or elsewhere, as always, I think you will find these segments to be particularly interesting and honest and forthright, and in some cases, perhaps not even too pleasant. It's not all doom and gloom now as it was in the past couple years, but it's still some rough seas out there, I think, in this world. And we'll circle back on some of that at the close of the show and some bits and bobs and other bits of news. But wanted to mention coming up here this weekend, Naufi, the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience, is taking place. It's really already on. If you're listening on the radio, the Royal Street Stroll is happening right more or less after the show ends. And then they have a couple events coming up. There's several events, dinners and some other things. If you're interested in hearing more about Naufi, go back and check out our show from May 3rd, so about a month ago, 3 weeks ago or so, and we chat with Amy Brown, who is the new executive director, and it's a very also forthright conversation about some of the challenges that Naufi has faced recently and what they're doing to address those challenges to make it a better event, kind of return it maybe to its previous glory. I want to mention that they're the kind of the highlight events, if you will, are the Grand Tastings, and those are taking place Friday evening from 6 to 9 on Friday, pardon me, and Saturday from 2 to 5. They're both at the Ernest Morial Convention Center. They're at 900 Convention Center Boulevard, and those are fun. There's lots of food, lots of wine, have a chance to meet some winemakers and these sorts of things that'll be out there, and there are VIP tickets, which get you in a half an hour earlier than the times that I just listed available, and advanced tickets, and you can also get tickets for $20 more. So advanced tickets are $129. You want to jump on that now. If you go the day of the show to get in, either tomorrow evening or Saturday afternoon, it's $149. If you want a VIP ticket to get in early, it's $195. Not sure if you can get those at the door. But yeah, do check that out. Obviously, friends, we're looking at the potential for some rain this weekend. We are wearily casting our eyes towards Invest 90L, as they're calling it. And, you know, if anything, it looks like it might be a major rain event and could come our way or nearby. And if anything, I think it's a good time to consider checking your tropical storm / hurricane plans. Make sure you're prepared. Yep, it's a little bit early. Technically, hurricane season kicks off next Friday, June 1st. But hey, here you go. It's a little bit of preseason here for you. Hate to make light of it, but maybe that's what this is. So, you know, be prepared and, you know, make your plans accordingly. Hopefully it cooperates with folks heading out to Nalfi and that sort of thing. Obviously, we had some crazy rain there last Friday. I mentioned that we taped at Longway Tavern, which we just did the other day, but I actually happened to be in Longway Tavern last Friday, the day after their grand opening, and conducting a little business, side note. But walked in there, and about 20 minutes later is when that torrential downpour came down, and ended up hanging out and having drinks and a lot of fun and a little bit of food. Figured, hey, why go anywhere? So we just sort of rode the storm out, if you will, and hung out there in Longway Tavern, but watched all kinds of stuff float down Toulouse Street. It was like a river. If any of you out there had some flooding issues, had damaged cars, my thoughts are with you. I hope that everything wasn't too bad. It's definitely a reminder that this is where we live here in New Orleans, and we have these problems, both unavoidable and arguably avoidable. I think we all know what I'm talking about here, but it is a good time to get prepared, friends, for these things as we move into hurricane season. So check your batteries, get your water, make sure you have a plan, a little bit of food, and always, you know, if it's never looking like it's going to be a good situation, get yourself out of Dodge. It's not worth, as we all know from previous experience, it is not worth sticking around unnecessarily, right? Yep. So there you go. Last, obviously, part of the rain caused a little bit of a problem with Bayou Boogaloo. It made, caused a lot of damage on Friday, and they had to cancel the event that day, but got back up and running on Saturday and Sunday. So that was good news. Friends, I wanted to mention something really quickly, too. I was talking about the New Orleans wine and food experience. And just a quick note that I want to mention. You know, wine festivals are a difficult thing. They're a difficult thing to run. They're a difficult thing to organize. It's difficult to make everybody happy. It's difficult to create a situation where both the guests get what they want, if wineries are out here, that they're trying to connect and share their brands with people, to actually have a meaningful interaction where their brands get exposed. You know, it's basically where I'm going with this is that it's hard to not have a drunk fest. I think that's something that Nalfi has struggled with in the past, and maybe it's a good time for 80% of the folks that are attending, but the 20% of us that want to interact and talk to the wineries or the winemakers who happen to be out here, talk to the chefs if they're there making food from some of the great local restaurants that are out here, it's really hard to find a balance. And I have some experience doing this. I used to do this type of stuff in California quite a bit when I worked in the wine industry out there. And, you know, I want to make sure that it's very clear that Nalfi is really trying to be a good event. And the challenges of running a festival that circle around food and alcohol is a very, very difficult thing. You got to ask yourself a lot of questions. Some people say raise the price. It keeps a certain segment away. Some people say no, just format it differently. There's a lot of questions to be asked. So I'll be interested. We'll be out there on Saturday at the Grand Tasting, and I'll be reporting back to you. This is really my point about some thoughts next week on where Nalfi has seemed to have gone, and maybe some things to think about if, you know, if you're going to a wine event, to try and get the most out of it, or, you know, alcohol event, try and get the most out of it, that from based on what you're looking for. Okay, that's really what I'm going with all this, friends. We're gonna take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Stay tuned for that stuff next week on our report on Nalfi. And we come back, as I said, we're gonna be at Longway Tavern chatting with Liam and Ro, and then we're gonna go right into our featured interview, where Ro sticks around. We're joined by Nick Dietrich talking about the hospitality and restaurant business here in New Orleans and beyond. Come on back.
Oyster rake scraping down Grand Isle Way. Don't get no more salty than Barataria Bay. 100 years my family's done it this way.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour, every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning into the show. Friends, as always, if you were listening at the top of the show, and I hope you were, you know that we are at the newly opened bar and restaurant here on 719 Toulouse Street in the French Quarter, Longway Tavern, and I am pleased to be joined by the co-proprietors, Robert LeBlanc and Liam Deegan. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, man. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming down.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, as I recall, the last time we actually did a show here a few months ago, we were sitting on the courtyard amidst all kinds of flotsam. I'll use that word.
It looks a lot nicer today.
It looks a lot nicer today.
It's going to go back to flotsam in a couple days.
That's good, right. We're coming while it's still pristine.
Absolutely.
Relatively pristine. And congratulations on getting the place open.
Thank you. Thank you guys for being a part of it and supporting us.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the tavern. Now, you guys, it's part of the LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group, which is, of course, Cavan, Sylvain, Mobar, and Barrel Proof. And you guys teamed up specifically to open Barrel Proof. And so this is collectively with the two of you, if I'm not mistaken, this is your second venture together in a spot.
Correct. Liam worked with us at Sylvain. He was our beverage director at Sylvain, and he thinks about things in the same way that we do in terms of it's about the experience and being fun and hospitality. He's just so much better than I am at all those things. So we worked on Barrel Proof together. Really like Barrel Proof. It's just a neighborhood bar. It's sort of understated in a way, in the sense that you kind of pop in if you just want a beer and a shot and have that low-key neighborhood experience. You can have that, but you can also get great cocktails, great whiskey selection. Everybody's really knowledgeable without being over the top with it. And it worked really well, and people responded really well. And we felt very strongly that we should do the same thing in the French Quarter.
Right.
And having Mobar and Sylvain here, we really get a chance to experience what the French Quarter could still use more of. And that's kind of a casual, unplanned place to pop into that still offers fantastic products, fantastic food, drinks, and hospitality, but it's not so expensive. It's not such that you have to have a big plan. You can just kind of pop in. And there's a lot of places that have
casual
opened.
Casual fine dining then.
Absolutely,
And let me ask you this question, Liam. So with the goal, what was the goal here? Because it seems this is a little bit more casual, right, than Sylvain and Mobar.
Yeah, I think, one of the easy ways to describe Longway is kind of a mix between Sylvain and Barrel Proof. I mean, one, because that's kind of where I am coming from, but also because it's similar to Barrel Proof. It's kind of a line blurring category for a venue. It's kind of obviously a bar up front, but then the menu is pretty fantastic food-wise. John does a really great job, so it's also a restaurant, but it's not necessarily a fine dining place. It's a super casual service wise. We want people to feel comfortable walking around, getting drinks in the courtyard, getting drinks at the bar. So it's not a place that you make, like, we don't have reservations. It's a place that you feel comfortable just coming in, having a drink. If you start to get hungry, you have some food, and then it could turn into dinner. It's kind of more of an organic,
kind of a free flow kind of thing.
Yeah. It's something that develops. So, I mean, similar to Barrel Proof, where you pop in and you have a beer or a whiskey flight, but you can also get some cocktails, hang out for a while before you go to dinner or something like that. So I like places that kind of aren't very specific in what they offer. You know, you can kind of pick your own experience. If you want to come here for dinner, it's a great place. If you, and you can think of it as a restaurant. If you want to come here after you get off your shift bartending or serving in the neighborhood, you come in here for some drinks and maybe a bite to eat. So it's kind of here for people to make it what they want.
Gotcha. And you're talking about John, referring to Chef John Sinclair, yes, who's your executive chef. And mm-hmm. John was doing the pop-up there at Barrel Proof, or generally the regular pop-up, correct?
Right, yeah. He was running the kitchen 4 days a week for Barrel Proof. And then we also, on the off days, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, we host pop-up kitchens over at Barrel Proof in the kitchen. But gotcha. So he was doing the food regularly at Barrel Proof, and then now he's doing the food every day here.
Okay, gotcha. Well, since we were on the subject of the drink and the food specifically, what were you guys gunning for? I mean, you've touched on this a bit, but what were you gunning for style-wise with the cocktail list, with the rest of the beverage list, the bar? Because, you know, we're a half a block from Bourbon Street, but you've got a fine liquor list, you've got a smart little wine list, and the food. What were you guys kind of aiming for with the menu?
We wanted something that felt as approachable as the place on Bourbon Street in terms of price point. And in terms of our attitude toward it, everybody's welcome. Everybody should come in and have fun. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't take it seriously. It doesn't mean that we can't do the best cocktails that we can possibly do. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't have a well-curated selection of spirits. And it certainly doesn't mean we should take the wine list for granted.
Okay.
And that was really the idea. And it's the same thing on the food side of things. The food is all really fun, really accessible. Nothing on the menu is incredibly expensive. But that doesn't mean that it shouldn't still be delicious. And John and those guys put a lot into it. And so it was just sort of understated place right off Bourbon Street that for people who wanted a little bit more of an intense experience without committing to more money or committing to a more sort of stuffier, planful experience.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it, because in looking, and I've been here a couple times, as you guys know, and looking at the menu, I mean, the cocktail menu, there's some thought going on. These are craft cocktails, to use the term. And I mean, in looking at some of the food menu that John's put together, for example, you see home fries, but the home fries have caviar and creme fraiche going on. So it is it's sort of a cut above what we might expect from a dive bar that does food in the back.
Right. I think the idea behind both the cocktails and the food is to be really familiar and comfortable, but still be really well done. I mean, as far as cocktails, I think it's my... The way I approach cocktails is kind of a don't mess it up. I guess I usually use a different word. it's a basically a don't mess it up list of pretty much just classics that I've found the recipes that I like for them, and maybe put a few tweaks on them. But it's stuff that's classic, tested by time. I think that's kind of our approach to the place in general. Mm-hmm. But the food as well is familiar flavors, and reads very familiar. Really?
With great familiarity.
Yeah, with great familiarity.
Well, we'll go that way.
but then when you get into the process behind it, there's a lot more care in the exact the products that are going into it, the quality, like what the process that John uses to cook some really familiar items is totally unfamiliar to me.
Yeah, okay. Gotcha. So with not so much great familiarity, what happens back there, it's just how it comes out on the plate.
Exactly, yeah. So it's stuff that you're comfortable ordering. You know, same thing with like a wine menu. It's wine menus can be uncomfortable for a lot of people, I think. But finding a way to make it approachable to people and still give them a new experience is I think kind of the way we approach the food and drink here and all the other places.
Sure. And you know, and we're going to do another segment with you guys on this, and I want to get into sort of the building and the backstory and some stuff like that. But it's a cool spot, right? Where, I mean, it's an historic building here on the 700 block of Toulouse, as we discussed. Very cool courtyard. The building's got a long history, which we'll get into. But you guys searched around. I guess we'll tee it up this way. You guys searched around for some options, right, before you settled on this place?
Yeah. I mean, it always starts with the building. And then what does that building deserve or warrant to have that would get people to feel comfortable coming back in and experiencing the history and the culture of New Orleans? And that's kind of where it always starts. And also, the other thing that's a critical decision point for us, while we take our products very seriously, we don't take ourselves too seriously. So it's really all designed to be fun for people as well. And we always keep that sense of the joie de vivre mind with everything that we do. So it's not, it's first and foremost, supposed to be fun for people. Right. And we never lose that in our identity.
And you guys opened up last Thursday.
Correct.
Yep.
And it's been, how's it been going for this week?
It's great
so far.
Lots of familiar faces.
Yeah.
Again, familiarity.
Yeah, with great familiarity.
That's my favorite word
my face. Yes.
Oh yeah, it's been great to see a lot of friends pop in. A lot of people that work in the neighborhood. A lot of people that have been excited for us to open and finally being able to come in and see the courtyard, see the bar, see all the hard work that everyone's been putting in to the building, into the space. It's been really great.
We got to wakeboard down Toulouse behind Liam's Jeep on Friday.
Yeah, I happened to
which is also amazing.
Happened to be here for that, which was it was great. It was, you know, water didn't get in the door.
One thing
that was the one place it did.
We've gotten a ton of support and high fives from friends who have places nearby as well, friends and neighbors, and that's a really cool thing that's going on in the quarter right now in general. Is we have a bunch of cool independent owner operators, all of whom are friends, all of whom support each other. So it's kind of this roving crew of scallywags,
yes,
hopping between all of our spots.
Something I think we're going to touch on after the next segment. We're going to bring in one of those scallywags to do that. He's sitting over here. But we're going to take a little break here, friends, on the NOLA Drink Show. We're chatting with Robert LeBlanc and Liam Deegan of Long Way Tavern. If you haven't been here yet, if you come in, it will strike you with a great sense of familiarism. How's that?
It works.
Great. All right. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Friends, come on back.
The French Market offers daily entertainment and delicious food and drink options throughout our 6-block district. Whether you crave raw oysters or fresh produce, authentic confections or healthy daiquiris, you can find it here. Sit at one of our cafes and hear live local music. Enjoy a muffaletta, po'boy, salad, or cheese plate in the farmer's market. Check out our pop-up farmer's markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays for even more fresh food options. History is being made fresh daily at the French Market. Visit frenchmarket.org for food, drink, retail, and event listings.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Thai Burger Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today on the NOLA Drink Show. We are chatting here at Long Way Tavern, the new establishment that just opened up, 719 Toulouse Street. In the French Quarter, located right between Royal and Bourbon, but I would say in many instances or many senses, a world away from both. We got a bit of a overview of the food and the drink and some of the style here from Robert LeBlanc and Liam Deegan, the co-proprietors. And we were talking before we went out on the break, talking a little bit about the building itself. Prior to being Long Way Tavern, it was Little Vic's Gelateria, which I think was a bit of a quarter institution to a degree, but I think let's kind of skip prior to that. It was a tannery, a leather shop, correct?
Yeah.
And I think that ties in interestingly, Liam, to the story of how this place exists and some of the inspiration behind it.
Yeah. So we talked about all the other venues we kind of looked at in the past, and we usually go, if there's a possibility for somewhere, we go and have a drink there. And this place was obviously, we went out in the courtyard at night, had some beers out back, and it kind of really stuck with us. And the more we talked about it...
I must have been a cool real estate agent to let you go back there and drink beers in the courtyard. Anyway, go ahead, sorry.
So after talking about the address, I think I mentioned it to my father after things started to move going forward. And he said the place sounded kind of familiar, that the number did. And I thought it did too. And so my dad sells belt buckles, and
so he makes belt buckles. He's a jeweler as well,
right?
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And he had always sold to a place called Waymire's in the Quarter before I moved down here for college. And he realized that was the same address that at 719 Toulouse was where Waymire's used to be located before it became Little Vic. So that was like, at that point, it made the decision even easier.
Right. And so, I mean, you had actually been in here with your dad, right?
Yeah, I my college visit, the summer before senior year of high school, like, was my first time. I did a Loyola Tulane, you know, school visit, and then it was also kind of a business trip for my dad. It was the only place he sold in Louisiana.
Okay.
He's based in New England, so it's very long shot for that to happen.
That's pretty.
But
amazing,
anyways, we visited with the family. They lived upstairs. Where we're sitting was our kitchen. Where the bar is was the kind of the showroom for all the jewelry and the leather goods. And out back, where now our walk-in cooler is, it was where his workshop was, where he worked on all the leather.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's very cool. That's really and very serendipitous, right? So, wow, that's an interesting story. And your so your dad, Jeff Deegan Designs, we'll give him a shout out there. And your dad just surprised you with a visit. Right there after the grand opening.
Dropped him off at the airport.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Around 4 o'clock this morning.
Oh, cool. Yeah,
he was sad to leave.
Yeah, I bet he was. It seems like he had a good time from what I saw.
Oh yeah, he had a blast.
So when you guys took over, when you purchased the building, you know, historical property, it's an old Creole cottage, right? A lot of work, man.
A lot of work.
I have a passing familiarity with how this went down.
Yeah.
But go ahead, man.
That's what happens. Just shack up with the art director of the whole project. Brian's wife, Sylvia, helped us tremendously. She's brilliant with plaster and painting and basically everything related to restoration. So thank you to Sylvia for helping us with this. But these old buildings, man, the cooler they are, the more beautiful they are, the higher maintenance they are. It's just like most things in life, right? So it was, but part of what drives Liam and I when choosing a space to do a project, we never start with an idea and then try to find a space. We always, a space finds us, truly. And you know, most of our friends will say the same thing. You're always finding things. We say no to almost everything, but this space really was a magical place. And the second thing that drives us is we have an obligation to be good stewards or the next stewards of these pieces of New Orleans history and architecture and culture. And so we understand that's what we're getting into, and that's what we've done at Sylvain. We've certainly done it at Barrel Proof and Cabin, and the latest one was here. So it is high maintenance, and it's a lot of work, but it's part of the process. It's also what makes the experience so magical when people do come in and they can experience the history. And we always talk about what we do is we try to keep one foot rooted in the history, traditions, and culture of New Orleans while we put the other foot in making a statement to what we think 21st century New Orleans should look like. And I think I think we're really proud of all of our spaces, but I think we've really been able to do that here in this space.
I think that's a great point. You and I were kind of exchanging, I'll use this term, ideas on a sort of a related topic about that. And I like that sort of instance. It's being authentic to the place and then taking a look at what you think a 21st century New Orleans experience should look like. And it's a fine line to walk, right? I mean, it really is a fine line to walk.
Yeah, because you want to honor tradition and history, but we, you know, Liam and I like old school places. We like dive places. We like places that are great and that have been around forever. And so the reality of it is you're not going to make a better French 75. So you have to figure out a way to honor the same principles that those places honor, but you've got to do it in a 21st century way so that you can create your own French 75 eventually.
There you go.
We're really intent on doing that. And we want to create places that last forever. And so that starts with loving places that have been around forever.
Yeah, taking care of the building as the bones, as we say, right?
Absolutely.
Now, so what you guys were kind of going for here, and we got about 4 minutes or so left, you guys, on this, sort of a mid-19th century Americana. Is that a fair way to kind of put the theme, more or less?
I think more mid-20th century.
I mean, excuse me, 20th century, not 19th century. I'm still
Liam was trying to be polite and trying to figure out how to say what the hell,
I'm still doing the math.
I have no familiarity or no familiarism with the 19th century at all. So 20th century, pardon me.
We've been hearing about that for a while.
Yeah, no doubt. Anyway, moving along, besides my lack of history. So mid-20th century Americana. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Kind of the general idea.
Yes.
Okay.
Part of that is we feel like, despite all of the things that occurred back then that needed to change and have changed, one thing that probably should remain is people's approach to drinking culture and camaraderie. And in the mid-20th century, and this is a romantic view, right? History judges things more favorably than it really was, typically. But drinking was more about camaraderie, and it was more about the idea of community, and, you know, people would routinely take the long way home. And that just meant you swung by the bar and got an extra couple beers. And drinking was, you hate to say, it was done more responsibly, but it wasn't really about just getting as hammered as you could get or going out and trying to pick up and things like that. It really was about camaraderie and just building bonds and relationships, even if with just your bartender or if the guy next to you. And you used to have these incredible journeys on a night out in a bar, just having drinks, talking to different characters. And I do think that's one of the things we both agree. It's one of the things that makes New Orleans magical is the reason why New Orleanians aren't as starstruck as most other communities is because you can go down to Miss Mays and you can sit next to somebody and you'll have more fun listening to that guy's stories than you would doing anything.
Yeah, right.
Relative
there's
to
no, the cult
stuff.
Of personality thing. Isn't
exactly.
Quite, or you could be sitting next to a famous actor and you're just a dude.
Exactly.
Or a gal. Well, and I don't want to, we've got about 2 minutes left, you guys. So this place did have a famous history of having certain authors spending some time here, William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway, things. So there's a great tradition of exactly what you're talking about here in this particular space.
Absolutely. The building was owned by a guy named Rourke Bradford, who was an editor at the Times-Picayune, and he was a writer as well. He wasn't as accomplished as those guys. And so we were a little reticent to put that out there, because there's really not a place in the French Quarter of New Orleans that doesn't claim that Ernest Hemingway hung out. That's right, probably because it was true,
right,
too, part of it. But it was a critical part of the story and the experiences that they created. They would always host people on their way to or from dinners or occasions in the French Quarter. And so it ended up kind of being this collective of writers. Rourke Bradford hired a young William Faulkner to write for the Times-Picayune. Right. And so it was just kind of this coagulation of these really interesting, creative writers, musicians, and actors who would hang out here and kind of felt comfortable just popping in. And the interesting thing was Rourke and Mary Rose, his wife, they didn't even drink at all, but yeah, they would host all these great parties
at night. Yeah,
yeah. So right.
Well, you guys, we got about a minute left, so this place is dripping with history, as many places in the French Quarter are, but you guys have captured, I think, much of the essence, and it's important to tell the story of these places. And if you come in here, you're going to see the story that's going on at Longway Tavern. Now, Liam, tell people where they can find reiterate the address and a website, Facebook, all that.
So
good
we're
stuff.
At 719 Toulouse, right between Bourbon and Royal. The address is www.longwaytavern.com. On Instagram, Longway Tavern. Same thing with Twitter and Facebook.
What are the hours, man?
We open at 4 o'clock every day with a pretty sweet happy hour, 4 to 6. Mm-hmm. And then the kitchen starts serving food at 5, and we close at 1 a.m.
Great. Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it. You said that with great familiarity, so I appreciate it. And come check these guys out at Longway Tavern. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to be back. Robert's going to stick around, and we're going to be joined by a fellow scallywag. Nick Dietrich's going to be joining us. We're going to talk a little bit about the hospitality industry. Come on back.
Hey ladies, are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yep, we are here at Longway Tavern. As you know, we spent the last couple segments chatting with Liam Deegan and Robert LeBlanc, the co-proprietors of said establishment, giving you the rundown on what you can discover for yourself here at 719 Toulouse, and I highly recommend that you do. Now we're moving into the featured interview part of our show, and Robert has stuck with us, buddy. Thanks for sticking around.
No worries, man. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you
suffering
very much.
Me.
Yes, it's brutal, man. We were just talking about that coming in. It is the NOLA Drink Show. It's brutal. But please be joined by, well, first time kind of participating in this conversation, but certainly a show veteran, excuse me, in front of the show, Nick Dietrich.
How y'all doing?
I'm doing well, if you're asking me, but I can't speak for anybody else out there, Nick. But Nick, you're the proprietor of the newly opened Manolito.
Indeed.
On Dumain and Decatur, a Cuban-themed and inspired bar. We'll get there, too, at the end. I'll make sure we get some discussion of that, and I think we're going to do something with you there pretty quick in the spot. And you'll have a new project coming up pretty soon that we can't talk about right now, but we will down the road. But what we're doing here, gentlemen, today is we're talking, as we do frequently, about the state of the hospitality industry, restaurant primarily with an emphasis on sit-down independent restaurants and bars here in New Orleans, just kind of checking in as we do about once a quarter to get your sense. And I know both of you guys are very honest about this. You both have had successes as well as taking some lumps in this process, and that's sort of what we're talking about here today. So thank you for that and your candor in advance. Nick, let me throw this to you because we were talking about this. One of the things that we sort of check in on is this sense of where the industry is. And I think we know that we, over the past couple years, it's been pretty ugly. We've lost a lot of places. And I would argue, and I think you guys would agree with me, that we lost a lot of places that are, they didn't go out of business because they sucked. They went out of business because of other factors. Mm-hmm. And where, so where, and either you want to start, Nick, where do you think we are now as after sort of about 2 years removed from some pretty ugly times?
Yeah, I think that, you know, and a restaurant can close for any number of issues. I mean, it could be location, it could be missteps, it could be like one decision on a key staff member that bites you. I can't curse, right? That bites you on the road.
We can bleep it out if we have to. I'd rather not. It's more work than I want to put in.
Yeah, I won't make more work for you. But I have, the word around town is that the sort of like trend of restaurants closing is sort of diminishing, but I don't think that is necessarily the case, as we were talking about a little bit before we came on air. I do think that there is just like a little bit more acceptance of that fact and like a little bit more normalcy. People on the guest side of restaurants are now almost expecting restaurants to have a lifespan that's significantly shorter than what it once was in New Orleans. I think, you know, you definitely have your old stalwarts, like, you know, all the Grand Dame restaurants,
Arnaud's,
and things like,
and
right,
so on and so forth.
That won't be going anywhere, but, you know, you're still seeing a ton of restaurants like Morning Call, for instance, closing. That's a big, big one.
Okay.
But also just like restaurants that have been open for 2, 3, 5 years, not lasting, and now guests are almost anticipating restaurants closing, and that's becoming a fact of life, which can be dangerous in the landscape of New Orleans restaurants. Because that's not necessarily something that can be kind of like poisonous to guests wanting to return to places.
And that's much of what this place is built on, right? In a lot of ways, is that this is not a sort of a turnaround situation or a carousel of restaurants where you want to come to a new place every time you come here. We have a lot of repeat visitors and regulars that want to go to their favorite spot every time they're in town.
Right. Yeah, I think restaurants in New Orleans have historically been more of a place of community rather than in the last 20 years, as the restaurant scene nationally has become more of a trending, like, facet of life, and Instagram like checklist. You know, New Orleans, if that is the way that New Orleans is going, then that's going to be a dramatic change for the restaurant industry in New Orleans.
Yes, and the fabric of the culture of both tourism and hospitality, mm-hmm. which I think is important. And one of the things that we have touched on before, Robert, and we'll throw this, because I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, is one of the sort of cryptic jokes is that the only time that you're in Eater is, you know, top 10 new places and top 10 places that closed. And that window in between is like 6 months sometimes, or 8 months. But what Nick is talking about, Robert, is that that is a frightening thing to the DNA of this place, potentially.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it is. I think that restaurants, great restaurants, will always last. I think it's getting a little bit more difficult to do that in the first year or 2 years. We've learned in our experience, Kevin most recently, Kevin took about 2 years and 2 months to like finally hit its stride and to hit the levels that Sylvain hit within 6 months, and that was we opened that one 6 years after Sylvain. So I think that just reassessing expectations and realigning expectations. The other thing that I'm finding, which is very interesting, we work pretty intensely culturally on leadership development, and talking to a lot of our chefs and sous chefs, managers, we always ask, what are your long-term aspirations? 2 years ago or 3 years ago, when you asked that question, everybody's long-term aspiration was to own their own place. And today, we're hearing a lot more, I just want to kind of be the lead of someone else's restaurant, or I want to be a head chef someplace, or I want to open a different hospitality-oriented business. So I think it has changed people's expectations. And in some respects, that's good, because people are more aware of what they're getting into, and there's not as much naivete around it. And in some respects, I think it's really sad, because I think you have people who would be great restaurateurs, great bar owners, who are getting intimidated because they're seeing places that they love and people that they love get dashed upon the rocks by closing, despite opening great places.
Yeah. Well, let's check a couple of these things down that you mentioned. And I know Robert, specifically when you've been on before with other folks, we've talked about some of the problems where I think people would move from somewhere else, say New Orleans is a magical place, they will just expect that I cook well or I make good drinks, I'm going to open a place. And they come in, they're not properly capitalized, they don't know what the summer means and low season means, because we're very much an ebb and flow or peak and trough kind of industry, and some other aspects of naivety. I think this is what we're talking about, is they're not, it's not called proper planning of knowing you have to weather 2 years perhaps to establish yourself, find your footing, build your reputation. You guys think that's a fair way to put it?
Yeah, and I think in some respects we've been conditioned to behave that way because we didn't have to. I mean, I'll be frank, we didn't. When we opened Sylvania, we were very lucky to have an amazing chef in Alex Harrell. We were very lucky to have an amazing bar director in Murph Reeves and people who cared. That's all we had. We didn't know how to really operate a restaurant. We didn't know how to really manage quality control. We didn't really know how to financially operate a restaurant. We really didn't have a ton of capital, so we kind of just shoestringed everything. But we could do that because it was a different time. There was less competition. People were more forgiving. Expectations were lower. Things along those lines. You can't really do that anymore. I mean, what we've learned most recently at Cavern, I'm really proud of the design of Cavern, always proud of the team, the food, the hospitality. Cavern, frankly, we didn't market it the right way. We didn't market it enough. And so that was literally the last example of you've got to be able to do everything at least decently to have a chance to survive. Whereas a few years ago when we opened Sylvania, as long as you had good food, good drinks, and you cared,
You do it well.
You do okay.
Well, and Nick, what do you think about this that Robert's saying? I'm thinking what we're saying is you have to not only do it right or better, but on a quicker time frame.
Well, it's really been like a whole new segment within the restaurant industry that has developed in the last 5-8 years, where now you can't just open up a place and have good food and have good people. You also have to have this sort of like outreach plan in order to get people to come back, because you know, just with the culture of scroll culture or whatever you want to call it, people on Facebook, Instagram all the time, that's becoming the way that you capture more guests. And you know, whether or not that's good or bad, it's the nature of it. And I think that's something that, since you know, the restaurant culture in New Orleans is so much more staid and older and established, it was a lot slower to adapt to that too. And I think that's also hurt some people.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Especially I think people that were coming in older mindset, which is what I think you're saying, but not the grand dames that we're talking about that don't need to do that.
Right.
Is that fair to say that? Okay. Well, you guys, let's do this while we kind of have that thought. Let's hold where we are right here, take a little bit of a break on the show, come back. We'll pick up with this topic. We're going to talk a little bit more about the state of the hospitality industry and some other connected components here in the Crescent City in New Orleans. So we're going to take a little break here on the Nola Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and podcast land, wherever you may be. Come on back.
Looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint, and it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning into the NOLA Drinks Show today, friends, or this evening, or this morning, or whenever you're listening to it, if you're listening to the podcast. I appreciate it as always. Speaking of appreciation, pleased to be joined by my friends Nick Dietrich and Robert LeBlanc, two fine restaurateurs here in New Orleans. And speaking candidly, as we do, about the state of the hospitality industry, especially as it relates to, as we were saying, independent sit-down places, bars, and this sort of thing. And you guys, when we kind of left off the conversation, let me ask you this, Nick, because like Rose talking about when during the time when opening Sylvain several years ago, it was a more forgiving landscape. Cane and Table came along a little bit later. Was that kind of in the, was it a tougher landscape, do you think, or was it still kind of forgiving vis-a-vis today?
It was definitely a little bit difficult to open Cane and Table just from the aspect of having only had experience working in the French Quarter on Bourbon Street, and then going to the Lower Decatur, which is a completely different animal.
Right.
But for, you know, the reasons of and what we're talking about here, I think it was more forgiving in that also there just weren't as many places downtown at that point either. I mean, you know, Sylvain was here and there were a handful of other places like in the quarter that were great, but it was a little bit easier to start to like dive in with Robert and like try to help start building the French Quarter, because I mean honestly it's still the place that I end up making my best memories in New Orleans, you know, on Mardi Gras or Halloween or and all of those things. So it definitely was more incentivizing for me personally to want to be in the French Quarter for those reasons.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So then moving forward, you guys, because and we were talking about this just now during the break, that there have been a number of places that have closed recently. Maybe we agree on this. It doesn't quite get the fanfare because we're desensitized to it. It's not quite maybe perhaps as widely reported now, or people are not shocked by it, so it's not wildfire on social media. But are we finding, Robert, that maybe we think people might be just kind of running out of gas?
I think that's probably part of it. I think one of the reasons why there's not as much fanfare about it is because I think when everybody used to talk about places closing, it was third party, very objective. Nobody personalized it. But when it's your friend's place, or it's a place that you love going to, or a chef that you really like and you know that works their ass off, when their place is closing, then there's a sensitivity to it. And so I don't think people feel so comfortable talking about it when it's in a personal way like that. And I think that's why it's more quiet. And I also feel like there's a new reality to opening a bar or restaurant, and it's kind of probably becoming as difficult as maybe it always was before this boom that probably started around the time that Sylvain opened. And it's just kind of going back to, it takes a couple of years and you have to apply your trade and you have to love what you do and you have to do it for pretty minimal return in the beginning. But if you do it over time and you continue to get better and better, it will grow. And for all the challenges of opening a restaurant in New Orleans, the one thing that I think we can both agree on is if you stick with it over time, you will be rewarded for that. And it is so much easier to sustain a restaurant here in New Orleans than it is in other cities like Dallas or Phoenix or cities that are bigger, faster.
Manhattan, like we're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you can kind of stick it out, then you will have places that will be around forever as long as you continue to care about the things that made that work in the first place.
Now do you guys think, is that because it's the nature of the city, it's the locals that are loyal to the place,
tourists like to come and experience a similar experience each time they come here? If they're repeat visitors, do you think all of the above, none of the above?
I think it's because people love history and tradition in particularly older cities. And in New Orleans, they come to explore those things. But I also think that I still feel like New Orleans is the best hospitality town, certainly in America. I wouldn't say the world, but certainly America. I think it's one of the best, or it's tied for the best in the world. And people always want to feel like they belong, and people want to feel a sense of being home where they are. And I think that we in New Orleans exude that naturally. And it just, it takes a little bit longer to communicate that, because people's bandwidth is stretched so thin because there are so many messages coming at them all the time. So it just takes them a little bit longer to find you. And so I think that if you stick it out, you'll be good to go. And one of the things that we wanted to talk about is, you know, the idea of work with other independent restaurants.
Before you go there, because I think you just touched on something, and let's hold that thought for 1 second, because you mentioned this, Nick, earlier. Ro, you're saying, you know, making sure you do things right, needing to be prepared to stretch it out for a couple of years. And Nick, you mentioned something about having an outreach plan. So what are some of the mechanisms that we're talking about here? What are you doing differently that you didn't have to do 5 years ago?
Well, I mean, opening up a restaurant can be very isolating, just because it feels like when you're going through permitting, all of those approval processes, it's something that it feels like you against the world. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to get like wrapped up inside yourself. And I think this is like a lot of new restaurateurs make this mistake. They don't reach out. They don't develop a network. They don't have friends who are also in the industry that they can ask them questions about, like, my landlord wants me to sign this lease. What should I expect my projections to be to match that? Or questions like that. And so without having that sort of foundation there, you know, you can set yourself up to make a lot of poor decisions when there's a network that is there if you engage with it. I mean, like, we're talking about how people's bandwidth are spread thin, and like the world is so interconnected now through social media and stuff like that. However, on the restaurant operator end, we're still not talking to each other as much as we should be to like make sure that we keep up with as quickly as things are changing.
And this is kind of where you were going, Ro. I mean, that I think is in nicely, well segued, Nick, in that there is a network here. And I think in a lot of instances, and not exclusively or entirely or uniquely in New Orleans, there is that support network. There is that opportunity to work with your peers, and the understanding that, you know, sort of what's good for the goose is good for the gander kind of idea.
Yeah, it's also it's more fun. I mean, there's more camaraderie, and I think that perception is always so different than reality, and I think it helps to just know the truth. And so I'm very proud of LeBlanc Smith, and people look at LeBlanc Smith and think it's this big restaurant thing that's been overnight success. The reality of it is Sylvain took about 6 months, because there was literally nothing that had opened before Sylvain since Patois in 2007. Sylvain opened in 2010. And Maurepas Foods opened a year and a half later. And that's really the two things that were around Sylvain. So it got to fruition in about 6 or 9 months. Mobar took us 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for people to know that. And it's not true that it's like this big shiny thing that was awesome and explosive in the beginning. Cavan is just starting to hit its stride after 2 years. And so I think once you start to talk to each other and mm-hmm. people can be honest about the reality of what's going on, it can manage expectations. Because I think it would probably really suck for somebody who opens a restaurant that's kind of not doing that well after 2 months to think that Cavan opened and it was gangbusters from day one.
Right,
and so
right.
Because my restaurant's not gangbusters from day one, I'm doomed. And that's not really the case. It takes time to make these things happen yeah. the way that they're supposed to happen. It
takes 10 years to be an overnight success.
Yeah.
Always. Right, there you go. Exactly. So I know this is kind of an unanswerable question, but when we're talking about restaurateurs that come to town or are here in town, I'm thinking the folks that are here kind of know this landscape, but the folks that move here, is it naivety that they don't take advantage of the network? Is it ego? Is it a combination of the two? Is it just because you're sort of thinking, like you said, Nick, earlier, it's you against the world, and you're just sort of fighting the fight that way?
Yeah, I think it's a lot easier for people who come from larger markets to continue to like have that like standing on their own island, every man is an island approach to things.
Okay.
And the fact of the matter is that New Orleans is an old community, with restaurants being a very foundational aspect of that, and also the way that restaurants interact with the like social and cultural landscape of the rest of the city is very interesting too, just in terms of like how to schedule your year, how to plan, like how does Mardi Gras affect business. A lot of people assume that it's gangbusters for everybody, but honestly it's gangbusters if you're on the parade route and pretty mellow anywhere else.
Especially right if you're trapped in the Circle uptown or in the square uptown.
New Orleanians are going to be cruising around with a cooler, a beer, and they're not really going to be coming into a restaurant where they're going to have, you know, Otter Pops and peanut butter jelly sandwiches, because that's what it's about. And if you're coming to the city and you don't understand that, then you may invest way too much effort into catching not a lot of capital off of that time of year.
Mm-hmm. Let's do this, you guys. Let's take another little break here on the show. We're going to come back. We're going to pick up a little bit more about talking about the network that is available to folks, and even though it's an informal network, to help yourself through this. And we'll also talk a little bit more about what we see in the recent months, some of the trends that we're sort of seeing here, friends. And we'll tell you where you can come check these guys out at their locations, too. We're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show, friends. Come on back.
My friend Clark lost his house when the big winds blew.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street, or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Sitting here, la la, waiting for my ya-ya. Oh. Sitting here, la la, waiting for my ya-ya. Oh. It may sound funny, but I don't believe she's coming. Oh. Oh. Baby, hurry, don't make me worry.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning in today. As always, friends, however you're listening to the Noel Drink Show, I always appreciate it. We are chatting with Nick Dietrich, who is the proprietor of the newly opened Manolito over on Dumain and at the corner of Decatur, and Robert LeBlanc, the proprietor of LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group, which has a stable of places now. We'll get to that, too. But you guys were talking a little bit about, I think it was an interesting point, understanding the seasonality here, and Nick, you raised this point excellently, I think, is that, well, people think, okay, well, we kind of know summer's not so good. We think, man, Mardi Gras, the holidays, after everybody's super stoked after summer, that they're just going to be all gangbusters and ready to be out and spend. But it's not quite that simple, right? It's location and some other factors.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think that there's two seasons in New Orleans, hot and cold, but in reality, there's Mardi Gras, there's festival, there's Saints, there's summer, there's real summer, and then there's September.
It's a town driven by Catholic guilt, so there's the early January, giving up booze, saving money.
Yeah, the Lent season.
And then the first 2 weeks of Lent
until
St. Patrick's Day.
And we joke about it, but it's a reality here.
Fish seasons and beer specials ease them back into drinking.
Right. Right. So, you know, and you mentioned this point then, Nick, that we're talking about people maybe naively think that Mardi Gras is going to be a boon. And maybe it is, like, you have this idea that you come out of the holidays, which might have been pretty good to you, and then you have that, depending on when Mardi Gras falls, 5, 6, 7 weeks in between, and it doesn't work for you. And that can create a difficult circumstance.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, if you don't understand... If you don't spend time working in New Orleans, then you're not going to understand New Orleans, and you're probably not going to be successful. So, like, a lot of places that branch out, a lot of franchises and things like that, just don't really do the due diligence, do the market analysis to have the proper tools to function appropriately. And so because of that, they will expand and contract to react to different circumstances, and all of those sort of moves that they're making are not always going to be in line with the way that the seasons here work. And so they're going to either, yeah, maybe succeed, maybe overdo it, or maybe underdo it and, you know, fail in a lot of different
ways. And miss
ways.
The mark, especially out of the gate. I think this right. is a really good point. And actually, and I won't name names in this particular instance, but there was a particular, I'll use the term upscale chain restaurant that was looking at this market for 5 years, and ultimately, and they wanted to be in New Orleans, in Orleans Parish specifically. And after 5 years, they came to the determination that they were going to open up a Metairie, and they opened in Jefferson Parish. And it, I'll just say this, it was a smart decision. I don't think that restaurant would have made it here anywhere. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Roy, right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think kind of to Nick's point, it's in all businesses, cash flow is typically more important than profitability, but that's probably no more so true than it is in restaurants in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. So you guys were talking a little bit about, and we've kind of dabbled with this issue, but you guys are friends and you guys have worked well together. And I know being a patron of both your establishments for really since all of them have been open for the most part, you know, I see how you guys operate together individually, you know, working together directly, and then also how your staff works and even how those of us who are your regular guests behave. And I'm sitting at Sylvain, I tell people about Cane and Table and vice versa. So where I'm going with this, you guys, is that, and Ro, you were getting there on this, is that you guys are friends and you want each other to succeed, and there's enough room for all the kids in the sandbox if we're doing this right. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's this idea of competition. You know, people don't really understand. They might look at Monolito and Longway, or they might look at Cane and Table and Sylvain and assume it's competition, and it's quite the opposite. It's camaraderie. It's friends. And, we accomplish a lot more working together and sharing insight, and it's just a lot more fun to do it with your friends. And it's not just us. There's tons of people. But that aspect of the restaurant culture here in New Orleans, I think, never gets enough attention. And it's also not something that's ever highlighted for other new restaurateurs to participate in and to kind of take advantage of that. We all know how hard it is to open a place. So when someone opens a place, you don't want to see them fail. We all also know that it doesn't really matter what someone that everyone else assumes is competition is doing. If you're performing really well to the best of your abilities in your own restaurant, you'll succeed regardless of what happens with anybody else. And so there's always times where you would make an assumption that you're competing with someone. You're not. You see, those are your friends. You're competing right. with yourself. You're competing right. with the ghost of the best version of yourself.
Well, and I think, and Nick, tell me what you think about this, that really kind of, well, let's start here, that there's something to be said for the fact, if I go into your establishment as a visitor, say maybe I'm, and I think it's kind of the norm here, right? This is my 10th time or 8th time in New Orleans or 6th time in New Orleans, and I've been to Cane and Table twice, or now, in your case, Manolito, and I say, I'd like to go somewhere new. What do you recommend? There's not only a value to, like, if you send them to Robert's place up the street at Sylvain, there's a value to Robert, but mm-hmm. I find as a visitor somewhere, I'm going to remember you for telling me to go to a cool place.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I've always trained bartenders to, you know, go the extra step, especially when it comes to curating someone's experience, because in New Orleans, it goes outside of the restaurant so much here. And so it's about like pulling out WWOZ Livewire and picking out like a good band for them if they're talking about Frenchman Street. Or it's about, you know, like drawing a map on the back of a napkin and saying, like, you know, this is Sylvain, this is French 75, this is Latitude, you know, and making sure that you curate their experience, because that napkin's going to travel with them. It may make it back to, you know, home or their hometown, and that's going to enrich their experience, and also piggybacking off of those other establishments that you know well, that's also going to further enrich their experience.
Right, and I think people remember that, and I think that's important. Do you have any thoughts on that, Ro?
Yes, I do. I think it's just so much easier and it's so much more enjoyable to work with people than to assume that you're working against people. And I think that's one of the things that is so understated, but it's one of the things that we enjoy most about it. I have a colleague in town, and I put a list together. I made the unfortunate mistake of sending him to Monolito first. He never left. I recommended the Papa Doble, which is a real haymaker.
Yeah, right. A
couple of those. And I got a text, apologize to your buddy Nick for me.
There is that danger. Well, let me ask you guys this question, too, because we got about 2.5 minutes. We'll take a break and come back to this probably. As younger restaurateurs in your shoes, and you're talking about, Ro, you mentioned this idea that people maybe misperceive the concept that there's competition. Everybody's competition to you. Even I think with the older generation of restaurateurs and restaurants, they're also not afraid, or they're not going to say, oh, these young whippersnappers, I don't want to have anything to do with them. I think there's, not with everybody, of course, but I think there's potentially a lot of support from those guys and gals as well, correct?
Look, we feel it in a real visceral way with Dickie Brennan because Tableau is next to Sylvain. I mean, I think we have I think the Brennan family in New Orleans created that legacy. You're not going to find nicer people than T. Martin and Lally Brennan and Dickie Brennan and Steve Pettis and Ralph Brennan. They've been so gracious to us, and they've been mm-hmm. so supportive, and that means so much when you feel like you don't know what you're doing, you have no clue, and when someone as accomplished as those guys say, man, you guys are doing great, we love it here, thank you guys so much for opening this kind of place in the neighborhood, it's really cool, and it's a powerful thing. And I think that we've learned that, and that's what we do. And I think the invitation would be, don't ever assume someone's off limits. Like, if you feel like you need some help, or if you feel like you could use some advice, don't hesitate to approach. Certainly not Nick or I, but we have tons of friends that are on their own places, and we all feel the same way, really. I
mean, I think one of the most giving people as far as like information on the restaurant and everything for me has been Adolfo Garcia. Like, he's someone who is like very willing to share a lot of like very valuable information. Also just talk about, you know, his like where he's succeeded and where he's failed, and I've learned a lot I've learned a lot in 20 minutes with him, like at times. So
right. Excellent. Well, you guys, let's do this. Let's take one more break here, and then we're going to come back. We're going to chat with you guys a little bit further on the topic, and then give you guys the opportunity after talking about all the difficult topics here to talk about your places a little bit, where people can find you and come check you out. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Nola Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Come on back.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc, a great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheer.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Thanks for tuning in today, and thanks again to my friends Nick Dietrich and Robert LeBlanc for being here, and thanks, Robert, for hosting us here at your new spot, Longway Tavern, buddy.
No, thanks. Thank you guys for being here.
Yeah, absolutely, my pleasure. And we're talking a little bit about we're going to focus here on the French Quarter for a minute, because that's where you guys are generally or primarily have operated with your businesses, and there are exceptions, of course. But and we were talking about the sense of how the neighborhood itself and some of the dynamic in the neighborhood is changing, maybe in part because short-term rentals are not happening as much as they used to here. Issue for another show. But and Nick, you point out that we're seeing more full-time residents move back into the quarter, and some other considerations about how the dynamic in the French Quarter is maybe changing back a little bit more to what it was a few years ago.
Yeah, I think, I mean, when I first moved to New Orleans, I worked on Bourbon Street, and everyone that I worked with at that point lived in the quarter. And that's just not the case anymore. Like, most of the people that I work with now in the French Quarter live in the Bywater, the Lower Garden District. No one really lives in the quarter, but I think people are starting to now move back to the quarter, which I think is, I live in Algiers Point now, but I've lived in the quarter for years, and I loved living in the quarter. Just like, it's one of the most magical neighborhoods in the country, mm-hmm. probably the world. And so just having the ability to step out onto the streets of the French Quarter every day is something that I want more people to experience, especially because like when I worked on Bourbon Street, that was not a great gig for, I mean, it was a great gig for some reasons, but like what made it great was just like every morning walking through the French Quarter, walking straight into my house, you know, which was like a 200-year-old like apartment.
Cheer you up after a rough shift.
It was just like every morning walking through the streets, I was like, you know, I'm in New Orleans.
Right.
It's still like, and that novelty doesn't ever really wear off, at least for me.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I think he nailed it. I mean, I think part of that is there's just more places that have opened with local sensibilities and with a care for the fabric of the neighborhood that is the French Quarter. People, those of us who live in New Orleans know it's a neighborhood and it's a very important neighborhood to the city's history, but people visiting just see it as an attraction.
Sort of like a playground, yeah.
It's a totally different perspective. But I think a lot of places have opened, and hopefully Longway is one of them, that agree with that idea. And so you have people with local sensibilities, both people who live in New Orleans and who visit New Orleans, who really appreciate that approach. And there's a lot, I feel, and we talk about this, we're both optimists, we see the world through rose-colored glasses, but we feel like there's more places like ours opening than there are.
Yeah, and I think
counterpoint.
And I think a big boon to the French Quarter, too, as far as visitors are concerned, is like there are so many visitors that want to like crack the culture of New Orleans. They want to feel like, they want to feel involved with it, and so they're going to settle in more comfortably into these places that are more directed toward local sensibilities than they are to chains and things like that. And I think that's something that hasn't really ever changed. It may have faltered here or there at certain points in history, but that is something that really allows people to feel a connection to this place, because you want to feel connected to it. You want to, you know, you want to walk through the streets and hear that music, you know, in the middle of the street. You want to go into a bar and see a regular just like get his gin and tonic with two limes dropped on him and with no questions asked.
Right,
you want to be a part of that. And I think that's why you're seeing more and more of these places. It's kind of becoming a snowball effect.
I think that's a great point. And I think in both the sets of establishments that you guys have run, one of the things I know as a local that I enjoy, and I see it in visitors, they like to be able to come into the spot because they know they're going to get good food, good drink, good hospitality. But then very often they're talking to somebody who's sitting next to them at the bar who's a local, who then gives a damn about their experience while they're here. And providing that venue, and I don't want to give this short shrift, the idea of providing a venue where me as a local, I want to go sit in that place, not feel like I'm overrun by tourists because I'm with tourists at care and vice versa, I think is an interesting dynamic. And I think it's not necessarily one to take for granted.
Agree with that completely.
Yeah, you've got to be a social animal to live in the French Quarter. And so like, and that is something that is a huge benefit to bartenders here too, because like if you have like 10 guests walking out and you're about to get rolled over, you can quickly introduce a regular to some visitors from out of town and know that they'll be taken care of while you help those 10 guests. It's a great tool for bartenders as well. And it's something that the people that live in the French Quarter, the regulars at these places, are more than happy to engage in, because there's not enough time to do everything you want to do, even living in New Orleans. So that way they can kind of live vicariously through that visitor too.
Right. You encounter people, when, you know, where should I go? You give them 10 places. When are you leaving? Tomorrow morning. Okay. Let me see if I can trim that down for you, or take that napkin home, like you said, Nick, and bring it back. Right. Well, I think it's an important part of the hospitality and the fabric of the city here. And I think opening establishments that understand that fabric is very important.
Stewards of New Orleans culture and history, and literally making that statement of what 21st century New Orleans should be.
Yeah. And yes, I think that's a great point, Ro. Well, you guys, we got about 4 minutes left or so. So Nick, let's start with you, because especially it sounds like most likely in a couple weeks we're going to be doing a show from your new spot. So we don't have to give the whole fandango here, but tell people about Manolito for a minute or two, man.
Yeah, Manolito is a place that we opened almost 2 months ago on Dumaine and Decatur, right around the corner from Two Jacks. It is Chris Hanna, Conrad Cantor, and myself. It is rooted in Chris and I's experiences in Cuba over the past several years, named for a friend of ours who was a lead bartender at Floridita for about 20 years, and unfortunately passed away early last year. And so this was something that Chris and I have talked about for years now, and when we had the opportunity to do it, the first thing we talked about was naming it in his honor. So we reached out to his family, and that's how it got the name Manolito. But very classic Cuban food, classic Cuban cocktails with like an emphasis on Cuban technique. Mm-hmm. So you won't find as many shaken or stirred drinks at Manolito. You'll find a lot of blended and thrown drinks, though. The emphasis there, as much as flavor, is texture. And so that's why we prepare our blended drinks in a very sort of fastidious manner, in the same way that cantineros in Cuba do.
Yeah, great. And we'll get into that in a couple weeks, what the cantinero culture is and so on and so forth. Robert, you have a few spots, man.
Yeah, man. Most recently, we have Longway, which is here in the French Quarter, and honored to be a peer of Manolito. And Sylvain, a couple blocks away, we have Mobar, also in the French Quarter, on the residential side on North Rampart. We have Cavan in the Garden District, and we have Barrel Proof, which is more of a bar in the Lower Garden District.
And you can find all those places online. It's LeBlancandSmith.com is kind of the catch-all for everybody. What's the website and Facebook for Manolito?
ManolitoNola.com.
Okay, excellent. You guys, thanks very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
Okay,
no,
great.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. We'll do
You're hard to follow, man. You're smart and you say all the right things. And so you ask my perspective right after you say something genius.
Good thing that this is ending here. I mean, we're gonna take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends. I'll come on back and bring myself down a few notches and sound incredibly dumb. Come on back.
Swing for me on a Mardi Gras day. Who's on this swing, I say? Tutti Marci show is fine. Who's on this swing, I say? Tutti Marci show is fine. Who's on this swing, I say? Tutti Marci drink some wine. Who's on this swing, I say?
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Every afternoon when I wake up, I say a little prayer and drink up, and thanks the Lord for driving me home once more. There's an open Bible on the table and an empty bottle on the floor.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian E. is here with you. Thanks for tuning in today. As always, friends, thanks for listening here on WGSO on the radio in New Orleans, if that's what you're doing, or thanks for listening in podcast land wherever you may be, if that's what you're doing. Always, please, friends, if you're interested in the podcast, go check us out. We're on all the major platforms, I should say, or most of them. I don't know what really accounts for all that these days, but Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, the National Food and Beverage Foundation podcast platform. There's one or two others out there where you can find the show. And if anything, if you're ever wondering where to go find it, the easiest place is probably noladrinks.com, because we have the links to all those different platforms where you can find the show, have the latest show, the show notes, links to other shows that have some connected topic material, for example. That can all be found there at noladrinks.com. And you can certainly check us out on social media at noladrinks, NOLADRINKS, on Facebook and Instagram, and noladrinks.com. the number one on Twitter. I hope you enjoyed that interview there. Obviously, the first one with Robert and Liam talking about Longway Tavern. It's a great new spot. Please do go check it out. You'll find us hanging out there quite a bit. And also, the interview, of course, where Robert sticks around with us, and we were joined by Nick Dietrich. I think it was a fascinating conversation, as it usually is when we talk about this topic material. And some of it is quite unsettling. I think, you know, we asked some of these questions. Obviously, we know over the past couple of years, it was very rough in the landscape here, as we talked about that, and we've talked about this particularly on several occasions.
a lot of places went out of business, not because they were bad. They went out of business because it's tough. It's a tough landscape. Now, some will argue the term saturation. You've heard us talk about that before. What does that mean? Are there just simply too many restaurants or too many restaurants, bars, whatever, of a certain ilk in the city? And I think obviously a lot of what I'm talking about here applies to a lot of locations, at least in the United States, and I'm venturing in other parts of the world as well. Some would argue, no, we're not saturated. It's really more a question of, did you put yourself in a bad location? Did you not think about certain things? Were you not properly capitalized to not turn a profit in 3 months? You know, all these different things. I think in some ways it's kind of splitting hairs. My view is I think there is perhaps a little bit of saturation here because, you know, it was that you could kind of open a restaurant just about anywhere, and I'm overstating, but you could open up a restaurant just about anywhere and you would do well going back a few years as long as you did a decent job. And now it's all of these factors are, if you did put yourself in a slightly less good, if you will, neighborhood, then it's a problem. If you're not properly capitalized, it's a problem. A lot of these things, when the restaurant industry and market was booming in post-Katrina years and really up until a few years ago, those could be sort of glossed over. And now they're manifesting in ways, because I think it is. There are a lot of places. There's a lot of competition. Everybody's trying to compete for your dollars and your time. And so we can argue the definition of saturation and what it means and what some of the underpinning dynamics are, but it's still a rough landscape out there. And it was interesting, as we were talking, some of this was on air and some of this was in between the breaks when we were having a chat. And I asked the question, you know, do we think, more or less, do we think that things have improved? And arguably, yeah, you know, a lot of places did better than they did the past couple of years in the same season, comparing seasons. But there was still a general consensus with Nick and Roe that more places are going to be closing up shop over the summer. We know the Morning Call location that had been there for 44 years in Metairie is closing up. And we also know that Angeline, maybe you didn't catch this, our good friend Alex Harrell's restaurant, located on a Chartist in the Hotel Provincial, is going to be ceasing operations at their current location. He's looking, apparently, haven't had a chance to talk to him personally, we'll do that soon, but looking for a new place to open up. So, you know, it's still a tough landscape out there. And I think what we might find is, you know, a lot of people got maybe weeded out forcibly, if we want to use that term. But then, I think what we're seeing now maybe are people that are just don't want to fight the fight anymore. The juice is not worth the squeeze, as it were, and might just choose to shut down. I think that maybe could, I'm just surmising here, this is based on nothing but just a hunch, that maybe that was the case with Morning Call closing down. You know, when they moved out there to Metairie 44 years ago, French Quarter was sort of in decline, and they decided to move out in that fat city area, which was where it was at. And, you know, they're keeping their City Park location open, so don't fear there. And they're even talking about looking into the French Quarter and moving back in that direction, as that place has, obviously become very popular again and turned itself around by and large. But it's still tough sledding. Certainly here on the show, it is something that we will keep you apprised of. Probably over the summer, we'll do another round of interviews when we're in the heart of the low season and just kind of see what we're seeing. So there you go there. I wanted to mention a little bit of news from the food and beverage world. One that I think is kind of interesting is, just came out, this is reported in the drinks business, that the trade deficit in the UK would be 3%. Or nearly 3% worse off without scotch. Think about that for a second. So they said in 2017, UK exports of spirits overall increased by 449 million pounds to 5.6 billion. That's a sizable chunk, with scotch whiskey accounting for 78% of all UK spirit exports. That's a big number, right? So overall exports of scotch hit a record high in 2017, growing in both volume and value by 1.6% and 8.9% respectively, to a total of $4.37 billion. Now, what they're talking about is that the UK trade deficit, which is currently 153 billion pounds, would have been nearly 3% worse, as I said, 2.9% worse without Scotch whiskey exports. And so single malt Scotch continues to grow significantly, boosting again the value of their exports. And also they're starting to note that it seems that blended Scotch whiskeys are also improving, which is kind of the bedrock for them, what they really need to improve. But the EU maintained its position as the largest region for Scotch whiskey exports, accounting for 32% in 2017. North America was second at 25%, and Asia was third at 20%. So, I mean, that's kind of staggering to think about, that 3% of the deficit will be higher just without scotch. And I think one of the take-home messages here it will probably have a ripple effect to us in some degree or another. Don't want to predict what that is. But, you know, as the UK exits the EU, you know, they're saying here, of course, that it's going to be important to continue to support basically support exports of scotch because of how important it is to the overall trade of the UK. I was totally taken aback by those numbers and what it means for the overall economy and trade deficit of the United Kingdom. Fascinating stuff there. And also leading into a little bit of other beverage news that kind of relates, I'll get to that in a second, how these two may tie in, is that sales of California wines reached a new high. The retail value of California wines in 2017 was $35.2 billion. This was also, by the way, reported in the drinks business. And this is the sixth consecutive year reaching a new record driving the wine sales in California, and most of what's driving the growth is the stuff over $10. Now, when we're looking at it from an economic and market segment standpoint, $10 is considered the premium category. You might think that's kind of odd. I know I've said this on the show before. We're thinking, well, really, shouldn't premium be something like over 20 or over 30? Really, because there's so much, you know, cheap wine, jug wine out there, and some things like that that really does drive a significant part of the market. It's anything over $10, you know, is what is considered a premium wine. So that was a 3% growth. Also, they're shipping 241 million cases. And the total domestic, that was domestically, then total shipments of both domestic and international exports were 278 million cases. Now, what I was talking about here, there's some other numbers I could throw at you. You can go check it out on the drinks business, but they're talking about how the premium wines, as I said, priced over $10 is really what's driving a lot of this. Now, I think what's kind of interesting here is that you know, the demographic trends of who's buying wine is really what's pacing a lot of this, and it's keeping in line with the age of the drinking population, which basically the drinking population has increased 10% over the last decade. So really, the per capita consumption is flat. We just have more drinkers out there and more drinkers drinking wine over $10. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the market is growing gangbusters, okay? It's grown, which in overall sales, gross sales, that's great. And cases shipped, that's great. But that's based on a lump of essentially more people drinking. Per capita is flat, and it's really kind of been that way for a while. I think one of the other challenges out there is the rise of the tasting room sales and direct-to-consumer sales. And essentially, there are more ways to buy wine now than ever. In fact, wine selling locations in the U.S. are up 20%. From a decade ago, 565,000 off and on premise locations. Now we have all kinds of stuff. You know, we're talking grocery stores. You can go to the winery. You can buy online now, premium bars, blah, 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 blah. It is a very scattered landscape now, friends, that it's very, very, very challenging. So yes, these numbers continue to go up, but they're seemingly fragmented more in where they're being sold. So individual outlets maybe are not necessarily enjoying this, in this case with California wines, a 3% growth. It's kind of going down more rivers, if you will, and into the bellies of consumers and wine drinkers. So it's still a really, really challenging game out there. And especially for marketers and winemakers and those making things, you look at these numbers and you say, hey, 3% growth of California wines, that's great. But I think if you look at some of the underpinnings, it's not necessarily, you know, yet, as we said, 6 years of growth in California in a row. I don't think it's necessarily a harbinger of, you know, continued greatness and significant massive growth. It's just more drinkers. And again, when we're talking about the individual channels, the places where you go to get wine, still experiencing, I think, a great deal of difficulty because of all the variations out there, how people are connecting with wine, which is a whole other subject. We've talked about that a lot on the show, how people get their information, how they digest their information, how it's presented to them, how they connect, how they find things. Do you drink the same old thing? Do you drink something new? All of these challenges create a very challenging landscape. Why I want to tie that back in with the scotch thing is that we notice, I think, kind of one of the common trends that we're seeing. We see this in tequila, for example. Also, we've talked about that on the show recently, that the premium stuff is where the growth is. So people are becoming more discerning. It probably means that we might be looking at a, you know, lesser consumption by volume per capita of things moving forward. That's speculation, but I think that's a reasonable hypothesis. But what we're talking about here is more of the premium stuff in the whiskey segment, the broader whiskey segment, and the wine segment, of course, as I mentioned, tequila, some other things. That's where we're seeing the growth. Some of the consumer stuff, the bulk stuff, if you will, the commodity stuff is really not driving the market anymore. And that can present a whole host of challenges for producers, especially those that have done that traditionally in certain growing regions that they're based on, in case of wine, that they're based on growing bulk grapes, for example. Lots to unpack there, but I think something to think about as we move forward. We look at pricings of bottles, how things are consumed, and how people connect with their favorite beverage. Friends, we're going to be back with a new show next week. We're planning on what's going on there, so we'll have some news for that online to let you know on our Facebook page about exactly what we're doing. But hey, we'll have a good show for you then. I hope everyone has a great holiday weekend. Again, be prepared for a tropical storm. It's a good time to get ourselves ready as we come into hurricane season. So remember, everybody, be kind to one another, help your neighbor, use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all.